This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Shore, left traditional politics for work that he finds connects in a more direct and meaningful way to the community. After serving as Senator Gary Hart's political director and Senator Bob Kerrey's chief of staff, Shore now works full-time directing SOS, Share Our Strength. It's a hunger relief and anti-poverty organization, which he founded in 1984. It provides financial assistance and other types of support to more than 450 community-based organizations across the country that help to feed, shelter, teach, and support Americans living in poverty. When it comes to fundraising, SOS has the golden touch. Just this year, it will raise about $16 million. Shore thinks his approach is a model that can be followed by other nonprofit organizations in these times of government funding cutbacks. He says he typically doesn't ask people for money. He organizes people to contribute their skills and talents.
We ask chefs to cook for us at Food and Wine Benefits. We ask writers to write for us, and we publish anthologies, and we do events like Writers' Harvest, in which writers all over the country read from their work one night of the year. We've also gotten involved in a large number of kind of marketing and promotional and merchandising partnerships with different companies and corporations around the country. So we've been a weird hybrid, Terry, of an organization that both raises money and distributes money. Most grant-making organizations, most foundations operate either from an endowment or from some large source of funds. And we only have the money that we raise or earn every year.
How do you decide who to give the money to?
Well, we've got an established grant-making process. We do two things. We receive applications from literally thousands of community-based organizations around the country who are doing anti-hunger and anti-poverty work, and our doors are open and always will be open to organizations like that. We actually fund about 450 of those organizations. The other thing we do, though, is we try and proactively, hopefully strategically, seek out organizations and approach them so that we can fund organizations who are doing really great work. So we're trying to be as least reactive and as most strategic as we can be. Our funds typically support the kind of emergency food assistance efforts that you would associate with an anti-hunger organization. The other thing we do, though, is try and get beyond just the emergency food assistance. We try and complement that work with efforts that'll have greater bang for the buck. We try and get more kids involved, for example, in the school breakfast program. It's a federal entitlement. There's 13 million kids in this country who, by age and nutritional status and income, are eligible for a free or reduced price school breakfast, but only 5 million kids get it. So there's 8 million kids slipping through the cracks, either because their schools have not had the hardware that they need, which in many cases Share Our Strength provides, or the parents aren't aware of the program, or what have you. But it's a program that's completely paid for and funded by the federal government. So there's a whole range of things we do like that, including some community development work, some job training work, some nutrition education work, all aimed at not just feeding people, but helping people get in a position where they're going to be able to support themselves.
I'm interested in the way that you go about raising money. You usually don't ask people to give money. You ask them to give their services. And you tell the story in your book about how this approach evolved. You'd sent a letter to a lot of chefs asking them to donate money, and you got virtually nothing in return. What happened?
Right. Well, when the organization first started, that was the idea, was that we would kind of have the Share Our Strength logo would be like a good housekeeping seal of approval. And if you contributed money as a restaurant or somebody in the food service industry, and our initial idea was to very methodically organize that industry, if you contributed money, we would send you a logo. And we sent out thousands of letters, and every day the mailman came and went, and there was really not a response for quite a long time. And we finally got a contribution from a very well-known chef named Alice Waters at Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. And she said, let me know what else I can do. And we asked her to write a letter, and she wrote to some other chefs. And we ended up getting a few more contributions. But what we started to realize was that really the last thing people want to do is put money in the mail. We ended up developing a program called Taste of the Nation, which we do in partnership with American Express. And one of the things we found is that chefs would rather participate by coming to a food and wine benefit, donating their time and all of their food and the help of some of their staff, when they would probably spend about $800 or $900, maybe as much as $1,000, really out of pocket cash to make that happen. They would rather do that than send us $100 once a year in the mail. And I think it's because people want to be connected. They want to be involved. They don't want to just write a check, drop it in the mail, and not know or have any contact with the organization that it's going to. The other example that really struck me and that I felt I learned a lot about in terms of the psychology of fundraising for nonprofit organizations is we put together a book of short stories with Random House's Vintage Books called Louder Than Words, and we asked really well-known writers around the country to donate work to us, new work. And, you know, an example that comes to mind is Ann Tyler, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist, called up and said, yes, she would love to donate a story. She gave it to us. We sold it to Ladies Home Journal for, I think, $4,500, and we included it in our book. Now, if I'd have called Ann Tyler and asked for $4,500 over the phone, I don't think it would have been a very long conversation. But she loved the idea of donating a story, even though it took her 8 or 9 weeks to write, and she called up every few weeks saying she wanted to re-edit it and would take a little bit longer. And a check would have taken, you know, 10 seconds. But this was a much more meaningful way for her to contribute. So that's what we've been looking for, and it's really reflected in the name of our organization, Share Our Strength. We literally try and find ways for people to share their particular strengths, what it is they're passionate about, and we'll take that and we'll convert it into money.
Now let's get back to the chef's event, Taste of the Nation. What's the event?
The event is an event that takes place every year in April. It's called Taste of the Nation, and in about 110 cities around the country, all the top chefs and restaurateurs, wineries, other purveyors of food come together in each city at a location, and they essentially put on a big food and wine benefit, but they donate everything. 100% of the proceeds from that event get distributed back to community-based organizations doing anti-hunger work. We did the event for the first time in 1988, and it raised about $260,000. The year after that, it doubled. The year after that, it doubled again. This year, 1995, we did the event, and it netted out, after all expenses, $4.2 million. So that's a significant amount of grassroots charitable activity to take place in the course of, you know, just a week's time.
And how'd you get American Express into the act, and what's their function?
Well, American Express is the national sponsor of the event. They had an interest in, I think, trying to hit a couple targets with one shot, which was to say that they were interested in being involved as a good corporate citizen, but they were also interested in doing something that would improve and enhance their position in the restaurant industry. There's an awful lot of restaurateurs and food service establishments around the country that have to decide whether they're going to accept the American Express card, and they found that working with our organization, they could really build very good relationships with a lot of these merchants and potential customers for them. So they've basically underwritten the organizing cost of the event through a sponsorship fee, and that enables us to distribute 100% of the proceeds.
Now, in addition to asking people to donate goods and services, you also have a more entrepreneurial approach. Your organization, Share Our Strength, sells a lot of things, from gift boxes of hot sauce to T-shirts, books, aprons, watches, lapel pins, caps, and tote bags with your logos on it. How did you get into that entrepreneurial part?
Well, one of the things that really struck us from the beginning, and this is really one of the central points of Revolution of the Heart, is that there are simply not enough charitable resources in this country or probably in the world to really effectively solve the social problems that we're trying to deal with. Charitable generosity is incredibly important, and it does an enormous amount of good, but it's just not enough. So we wanted to create new resources. We didn't simply want to be in the position of redistributing wealth. We wanted to be in the position of generating wealth of our own. It's what I would call community wealth, in the sense that it doesn't make my wallet thicker or my house bigger or anybody else who works at SOS, but it certainly enriches the communities in which we work. So we got into the business of both creating lines of merchandise, also of licensing our logo. There are organizations, for example, like Fetzer Vineyards, which is a winery that markets to restaurants around the country. And one of the things they have found is that they are in a stronger position to go into a restaurant and get that restaurant to stock their wines if it has the SOS logo on it, because the odds are that that restaurant is helping in some other way with our hunger activities, and they would be sympathetic to that. So we actually enter into marketing, licensing, and promotional contracts with a number of large companies around the country, wineries like Fetzer and Gallo, companies like American Express, and the relationships we have with them, and this is one of the things that makes Share Our Strength different, I think, from most nonprofits, is that we are not receiving money from their charitable foundations. We are entering contracts with their marketing departments or their sales department or their promotional department. And that's commerce. It's business. Same with the books that we put together. I was mentioning Ann Tyler contributed to one of our first anthologies that we did with Random House. That is a straight business transaction between Share Our Strength and Random House. And to the same extent that any small business is actually making the economy grow and making the GNP grow and creating jobs, I feel that Share Our Strength is doing that, and that we're in a position of, as I say, not just redistributing other people's money, but creating wealth of our own, just a different kind, community wealth.
My guest is Bill Shore, founder of SOS, Share Our Strength. He's written a new book called Revolution of the Heart, A New Strategy for Creating Wealth and Meaningful Change. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Shore, founder of Share Our Strength, a group that raises money to fight hunger and poverty. Now let's get to what you describe as the nonprofit mentality, which is to keep costs low, you work with a lot of volunteers, your professional staff is paid as little as you could possibly pay them. What's wrong with that approach?
Well, it drives me crazy, is what it does, because you just can't build as professional and as powerful as an institution as I think you need to do to deal with some of the very difficult issues we're dealing with today. I mean, if you were starting a business today, if Terry Gross were starting a software company or a restaurant or a bakery or whatever it was, you know, the notion that you would start it by asking some people to volunteer for you and by having donated equipment and having old secondhand used furniture and not having a great advertising firm or communications firm, you would be destined to fail. It's a very competitive marketplace out there, both for for-profits and for nonprofits. And I believe that nonprofits need to pay good salaries, they need to have full benefits, they need to avail themselves of consultants and communications experts and design strategists. If the work you're doing is important, if you think it's important, I think you've also got an obligation to market it, to promote it, and to bring every resource that you can to the table on your behalf.
How do you set your salary at Share Our Strength? You don't believe people should be martyrs just because they work for a nonprofit. On the other hand, if your salary is too high, people would probably figure, well, why should I be sacrificing my time to pay his big salary?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, we try and do, we do two things. At Share Our Strength, we try and, first of all, set salaries that are designed to enable us to get really good people, and most of our senior staff has been with the organization for 7 or 8 years now, which I think gives us a big advantage in terms of really being able to get our work done professionally. The other thing we do, though, is we hired a salary consultant to let us know what the spectrum of salaries were across the range of nonprofits, and the salary consultant took our organization and compared it to other organizations of our size and of our revenues and let us know for each of the positions in the organization what the high end was, what the low end was, and what the midpoint was. In my case, I set my salary below the midpoint for just the reason that you've described, so that if anybody questions it, they'll at least know that what my salary is less than the median for nonprofits across the country, and I think that would be reassuring to them. The only other thing I'd add, Terry, is that the really important thing is I think not to worry about salaries and administrative costs, but impact. I mean, the measuring stick should be impact. Is Share Our Strength getting done the job that we say we're getting done? If we are, I don't think people should be troubled by any of the rest of it.
Would you like to see the government get out of the world of funding nonprofits?
No, it'd be a disaster. I mean, you know, no nonprofit or no collection of nonprofits are ever going to be able to make up the resources that government can provide. So I think government funding of social services is critical. From a practical point of view, there's no substitute for it. And just from a moral point of view and from what's right, I think it's, you know, a strong activist government is what this country needs. That said, there are things that government can't do. I think government can provide the funds. I don't know that government can always run and execute the programs. I think there are things, frankly, that only you and I and our colleagues and neighbors can do at the community level that can really affect people's lives. We've got a program at Share Our Strength right now called Operation Frontline, where we train the chefs who have helped us raise money, and then we deploy them into maternal and child health clinics and community centers where there's families on, with fixed incomes. They teach nutrition education, grocery shopping, food budgeting. They are connecting with people over food. These chefs don't consider themselves social workers or political or community activists. But they're providing a service that, you know, I don't know that government could provide. Government could certainly support it financially. That would be a very valuable thing. But I don't know that government workers can solve social problems.
You first got into the business of raising money to combat hunger after the Ethiopian famine. You were reading about it, I think it was 1984?
Right, right.
And you write that you were very moved when you were reading that hundreds of thousands of people might die soon, and that when you were that moved, you realized it was the first time in years that you'd had an opinion of your own.
Right.
Because at the time, you were working for Gary Hart. You'd been in politics, and when you had an opinion, the opinion was, what will the candidate I work for think of this? How will this affect him politically?
Yeah. I mean, I guess everybody in their life comes to the point where they realize that it's time to start thinking for themselves, and I hope most people come to it earlier than I did. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. I mean, I had worked so closely with Senator Hart for so long that my reflexes were to think about what he would say about an issue, what kind of press release he would put out about an issue. I was really, you know, geared all of my thinking towards what was good for him, as opposed to also thinking about what my own opinions were about things. And this tragedy in Ethiopia in 1984 was of such enormous magnitude that hopefully you couldn't do anything but have an opinion of your own. And I didn't start to pay attention to that kind of impulse because it was the first time I'd had it in quite a while.
You loved politics when you were growing up, and you say that you believed in government's power to make life better because you saw your father do it. Your father ran the district office of your local congressman, Bill Moorhead. I think this was in Pittsburgh.
Right, right, exactly.
What looked so good about what your father was doing?
Well, it was enormously attractive then and now. You know, some of my most vivid memories are of, you know, going up to the corner pizza parlor with my dad and it taking, you know, 2 hours to get up and back for all the people who would stop and ask about their Social Security check, or could he get their son-in-law into the country, or could he get somebody into the Air Force Academy. And he was just helping people on a one-on-one basis. You could literally see their eyes light up when he would give them some reassurance. He represented to them this enormous power of the federal government. He was their closest connection to it, and it made me realize that, you know, government can help people that way. But it also made me realize there's no substitute for people being involved in a one-on-one basis like that.
Did you feel connected to the people that way when you were working for Senator Hart?
I didn't. No, I really didn't. I mean, I worked in his Washington office. I traveled widely on his behalf and with him. But basically, we were working on getting legislation passed and working on sometimes symbolic victories. Or, you know, if you look at what's gone on with Congress over the last month in terms of this clash over how to keep the government running. I mean, these are basically huge symbolic battles that have consequences down the road, but are not, you know, really what my neighbors are thinking about affects their lives. And I think people in most communities feel the same way.
My guess is Bill Shore, the founder of Share Our Strength, and this is a group that raises money and then gives the money to groups that work with feeding the poor. How do you handle it? Since your new book is about nonprofits and how alternate ways for them of making money, how do you handle it when you get a direct mail solicitation?
Well, I don't read most of them. I get an awful lot of mail, and I'm on a lot of people's lists. But to me, that's just not that. That's not the way that I want to personally get involved. I don't know. I toss out most of them, and we tried direct mail at SOS once, and it turns out that most people tossed out ours. So I think we're even in that regard. It's just you know, even the best direct mail efforts get a 1% or 2% return. The other reason I think this is important is not just because it's not financially rewarding necessarily, or at least that it wasn't an organization. To me, the key thing is to get people engaged beyond money. I mean, we're not going to out-fundraise hunger. Share Our Strength is not going to be successful in out-fundraising hunger. This is not like the Jerry Lewis telethon where we're trying to get the thermometer to pop through the ceiling at X number of million dollars. Ultimately, we need to get people, average people, citizens, who up until now have considered their citizenship responsibilities to vote and to pay taxes. We need to get them engaged in a hands-on way, in a way that can really be transformative both for themselves and society. And direct mail doesn't do that. I mean, direct mail is the least connected way of getting somebody involved in your organization.
When you're working down a city street and you get panhandled, what do you do?
I do a couple different things. Sometimes I walk by and I always feel lousy about it. Most of the time, if I can talk to the person who's asking for money and let them know where there's a food assistance program, because in our neighborhood at Share Our Strength, for example, in Washington, D.C., there's a truck that comes to the corner a couple times a day. So I'll let them know about that. I mean, one of the problems is the people that you see on the street are really just the visible tip, and I think of an iceberg. And there are literally thousands of people who are hungry and who are homeless who do not panhandle. And they take advantage of the resources that exist. Usually if somebody's on the street asking for money, it's because they've chosen not to go to a shelter, in some cases for good reason, or to another type of facility. They're very often using the money for drugs or alcohol. They're very often mentally disturbed. It's not true of everybody on the street, but the higher percentage of people on the street, and it really misrepresents who's hungry and who's homeless in this country.
Bill Shore is the founder of Share Our Strength, SOS. He's written a new book called Revolution of the Heart, a new strategy for creating wealth and meaningful change. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.